Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you here this morning. The title of my presentation is Oral Health of Infants and Toddlers, Are Best Practices Falling Short? And maybe I should tweak that a little bit, because the real question is, are best practices really being understood, and are they really being implemented? I'd like to thank my co-authors, Stephanie Ettinger DeCuba, who is here in the audience. She's the Research and Policy Director of Children's Health Watch, and Diana Cutts, who is the Assistant Chief of Pediatrics at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. And of course, the whole Children's Health Watch research group, which is comprised of many pediatricians as well as public health professionals, and I'm very proud to work with this group. I have no personal financial or commercial interest to disclose, although in the sense of disclosure, I must admit that I do not floss every day. I am trying. A little bit of levity. Children's Health Watch began in 1998. Children's Health Watch was founded by Dr. Deborah Frank of Boston Medical Center and her colleagues. She founded this as a response to the Welfare Reform Act in 1996, where they wanted to monitor the child health effects of the Welfare Reform Act. And this has been going on since 1998, and they thought they might be done with their work after they found out what happened to children after the Welfare Reform Act. But things keep changing, policies keep changing, and there's always something new to look at. So we're really a source of really credible, timely scientific research and of informed, nonpartisan policy analysis on a broad range of issues affecting children's health and nutrition, including oral health. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this article from 2007 where a boy died after a tooth abscess spread to his brain. 12-year-old boy. He could have had an $80 tooth extraction if his mother had been insured, if his family had not lost its Medicaid, if Medicaid dentists weren't so hard to find. After listening to our presenters, today, I'm wondering, were there barriers to getting insurance? Was there neglect happening? There's just a whole host of things. I don't know enough about this case, but it's definitely tragic and it's avoidable. Some background. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that caries is the most prevalent infectious disease in our nation's children. It's 5 times more prevalent than asthma. The prevalence of caries in poor U.S. children under the age of 5 is increasing, although the prevalence for kids over older kids is decreasing. Also, in lower-income families with federal poverty levels less than 100% of the federal poverty level, those kids are at 3 to 5 times more likely to have early childhood cavities than children from families with better incomes. So early access to oral health care. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry recommends that children have their first dental visit by the age of 1. The American Academy of Pediatrics, or the AAP, also endorses this schedule. The AAP has a policy statement that they put out in 2009 that pediatric care providers should develop the knowledge base to perform oral health risk assessments on all patients beginning at 6 months of age. And children at risk of developing dental caries or fall into recognized risk groups should be directed to establish a dental home by 6 months of age after the first tooth erupts or by 1 year of age. So our study objectives at Children's Health Watch were twofold. One was to determine if recommended professional guidelines were being followed by our study sample. And number two is to examine the associations between oral health status in our children and adverse child health outcomes. We had a sample of 3,182 mothers of children between the ages of 1 and 4, and they came from 5 urban medical centers that are part of Children's Health Watch, from Boston, Minneapolis, Little Rock, Arkansas, Philadelphia, and I'm always going to forget one, and Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland. So interviews were completed. Interviews comprised of demographics, food insecurity measures. There were 5 questions on oral health that were validated questions. And there's also many questions on cumulative hardships. Data was collected from February 2011 to December 2012. The questions from oral health were from the National Survey of Children's Health, and as part of the interviews, children were weighed on each visit. All children had public insurance. It's primarily a low-income population that we study, and within this study, the primary independent variable was mother's report of fair or poor oral health in the index child. We looked at several child health outcomes, 7 to be exact. One was general child health being rated as fair or poor. One was standardized weight for age. One was being at risk for underweight, defined as weight for age less than the 5th percentile or weight for height less than the 10th percentile. Overweight, defined as weight for length greater than the 95th percentile and BMI for age greater than the 85th percentile for children greater than 2 years of age. We also used the Parents Evaluation of Developmental Status, or the PEDS. This is a validated instrument to look at developmental delay among children. We looked at lifetime hospitalizations and a well-child composite, which means the child has good or excellent health, has had no hospitalizations, they do not score at risk on the parent's evaluation of developmental status, and their anthropometric measures fall within normal realms. We used unadjusted analysis, and we also used multivariable logistic regression models to examine the associations between the index child's oral health status and the outcomes, the 7 outcomes of interest that we mentioned. So some of our results. One of our questions was, has your child ever been to a dentist or been seen by a dental health provider? And I remind you, these children are between the ages of 1 and 4 years of age. And 63% had said no, while 37% said yes. So the 63%, that's about 2,000 of our sample. And 8% of our sample, the mothers reported fair or poor oral health in the index child. In this slide, this is depicting the standardized Z-score for weight for age. And the solid red line, if you could see that okay. I got a little arrow coming in. And the solid red line are kids that were fair and poor oral health, in fair or poor oral health. And you can see that the line is kind of shifted to the left. So if you're familiar with Z curves, one area there, that's 2 standard deviations below the norm, below 0, and it's really shifted. And that was statistically significant. This table looks at our other outcomes, the other six outcomes, and just for ease so I don't get tongue-tied, I'm going to call the independent variable poor child oral health. The reference variable is good or excellent oral health, and then along that left-hand bar, along the left-hand bar, we have our outcomes of interest. So children who reported with poor oral health were 3.5 times more likely to have general health that was reported as fair or poor. Children with poor oral health were almost 2 times as likely to be at risk of being underweight. Children with poor oral health, there was no significant association with being overweight. And the next table is similar, looking at the next 3 outcomes that we looked at. Children with poor oral health were more likely to have 2 or more concerns on the PEDS scale. There was no significant association with lifetime hospitalizations. And most strikingly, the kids with fair or poor oral health were almost half as likely to be seen as a well child on our composite scale. And these were all adjusted models for background demographic characteristics, and we also controlled for child food insecurity. So despite the recommendations, the majority of young children in this sample had not seen a dental provider. Fair and poor oral health was significantly associated with being underweight, having general fair or poor general health status. Kids were more likely to have developmental risk and a decrease in the composite measure of child wellness. So what are the implications? They're fourfold that we came up with. One, it has to do with education, dental education. Not all dental schools in the United States have made hands-on infant oral health care programs a reality in their pre-doctoral programs. It's an interesting aside is I did a little pilot study with coworkers in my office who have young children, and I asked them, one of them has a child who's 3 years old, and I said, were you told to bring Emily to the dentist by the time she was 1? And she said, no, but I was kind of aware of the guidelines. And I said, well, did you ask your dentist what to do? And the dentist said, well, see if she has some brownness in her mouth. So she said, no, she doesn't have any brown teeth. So the next time she was recommended to come in was when Emily was 3 years of age. And by that time, you can probably guess what happened. She had dental caries. So there's a gap. There's a gap there between what's happening and what's getting disseminated to people in the community. So healthcare providers, just encouraging a dental home being so paramount to improving oral health. And I love that figure of the head separated from the body. We're holistic. Oral health is, part of our overall health. And then looking at at-risk populations, children at developmental risk and probably children that are living below the federal poverty level may need targeted interventions. And also reimbursement rates. Certainly there's barriers. Many dentists, including pediatric dentists, do not accept Medicaid insurance. There's some implications with the Affordable Care Act that things might be improving, I have a note right here, if you bear with me. But I can't find it right now, but it looks like by 2018, they expect much more dental health care from three sources, from Medicaid reimbursement, from medical exchanges, and from private insurance companies. Hopefully dental health parity is on our horizon in the near future. And thank you very much.
We have some time for questions. Alice? Are there any more questions? Any comments? We still have some time.
Was a parent who gave what you consider to be a wrong answer people were adherent, they recognized that they were sympathetic to the barriers. For instance, we asked about different ways to also talk about mouth to mouth sharing, about how people mouth to mouth share, and so the cadre of examples were ranging from, you know, sitting in a pacifier, using the sage spoon, to, you know, sharing gum, to picking off gum off the street. And so parents were like, oh, you know, of course they would never let their children do that, but they said, well, oh, my kids done that too. And they were sympathetic to things like the fathers being both a partner, and my husband told me I just need to do this. He told me to leave the room because I can't handle the child crying and let me do it, to I need to get up in the morning and I gotta sleep and just get involved. So it was, we were expecting to hear the latter answer, but we were pleased to hear that some of the fathers were the ones that said, listen, you need to go outside and just chill and I'll take care of the child when he's crying. So, and they were sympathetic to each other. And it was the focus groups were great. People were, for the most part, quite willing to express their opinions. They felt empowered, I think, by the focus group. Somebody was actually asking them what they thought. And so much more came out than I thought. It was, they valued that we were asking their opinions.
So somebody also had a question about their pain.
I had a question for the first speaker, and I just wanted to mention that I appreciated the child sound resources that are available on the web, and the studies that have been done on the child sound program. Are you thinking about that you will provide education to home visitors about conducting assessments and what to be doing and how they be considering that as part of their assessment?
Yeah, I think, can you hear me? I think it's important that in Scotland at the moment we are not training any more public health nurses or health visitors. So within a wider political context, the UK government is saying health visitor role is really, really important. We need to put money into it. But they're not putting money into training, so there's a mismatch between what they're saying and actually what we can deliver. So we've been working very closely with the National Health Service providers of education to say this should be part of the curriculum, and they agree with that and have asked us to go in and provide that. But at the moment, those curricula don't exist because there's no funding for them. So there's a bit of a mismatch between rhetoric and reality at the moment. But we're in there at the early stage, so when it comes round to that, we will be well placed for that.
Yeah, I would just like to bring up a point. What we have started doing with our similar kinds of things, both prenatally and for early childhood from 6 and younger, instead of focusing on the transfer of bacteria from mom or other caregiver to the infant, because I don't think you're going to stop families from doing this. It's just not logical. And I think it makes more sense, and the direction we're going in is make sure, as best possible, that mother's mouth is free of active disease, and then you've already reduced the bacterial load. And I think this makes more sense than telling them, don't, you know, kiss your baby, or don't feed the baby from the tomb. And I think you have to think about it in that direction a little bit.
Can't agree with you more. So I think that mouth-to-mouth sharing is the hardest behavior, and in the focus groups that we've done on that video post, there are some families that still feel like that's something they like to do and that they would not stop doing. It's just too convenient. So I think, and we would never want a mother to stop kissing their child.
Exactly.
There's just no way. And so that is a really tricky behavior. So I couldn't agree with you more about trying to control the bacterial count in the mom's mouth. And if anybody knows how to do that well, then let us know. You know, for hexagen washes, then, you know, thank God in my state we just got an adult dental benefit, which now will provide dental care to the pregnant women. But before that, they didn't have a dental benefit. In a poor community. So if anybody has ideas on how to best tackle that one, please say so.
Any more?
Institute for Clinical Excellence, NICE, which this gives the guidelines for the whole of UK, has recognised this problem and just came up with a guideline last year around how to recognise child maltreatment and what you do about it. In the UK, at the moment, it's important, we don't have mandatory reporting in the same way that you have here. But the weren't that many dentists included within, or dental practitioners included within the sample that NICE came out with. So we have a study at the moment that's looking at it from the dental practitioner's point of view, saying, well, what would be the consensus amongst you as to when might you report? Because there is this ambivalence, this fear about, well, is it bad enough? When? How bad is it to be able to do something? When should I say something? And so forth. So we are working very, very closely with both NICE and with the dental practitioner bodies, national bodies, to say at what point might we consider this as a child protection issue. Because, of course, people, I mean, generally speaking, health professionals are afraid of child protection issues. They don't want to get involved. They don't know, they might get it wrong. They might make it worse. People get very, very upset about it. So we need to give some sort of clearer guidance and more reassurance and training around that. So we are working with the national bodies around that. But I do think we have a long way to go.
Any more?
I have a question for Dr. Ida. So you talk about social support, and we have looked at the sense of coherence. So I don't know if anybody can speak more about the sense of coherence, but it's essentially what I understand of it as a person's ability to be socially supported, to then have confidence and their ability to then act, be active more than passive. And so those are all things that are hard to change from an intervention, and you know, how can we help parents become, have a higher sense of coherence? And they're more related to the social determinants of health, like poverty and stress and discrimination. And so you have four different forms of social support, and if you could speak to ones that we actually might be able to impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Those, you know, whether or not a person can, you know, develop effective, you know, social relationships, you know, that generate, you know, more like a supportive, you know, networks, depending on the personalities, you know, also the health status, it is affected by multiple factors. But I think, you know, what I focus in this study is more like a personal level of social support, but there could be a formal type of, you know, social support. For example, early Head Start programs is a sort of, you know, formal social support systems. So, you know, those mothers who are not very, you know, good at like developing, you know, friendships or, you know, having effective relationships in personal life could be supported by this formal structure around them, you know, to provide help and being, you know, supported.